सहनावतु सहनाभुनक्तु सहवीर्यंकरवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्ति।
38 38, right?
Yeah.
It's okay, after me. Soham vicharo vapuratma bhave. Soham vicharo vapuratma bhave. Sahayakari paramarganasya. Sahayakari paramarganasya. Swatmaikya siddhau sapunar nirartha. स्वात्मैक्य सिद्धौ स पुनर्निरर्थः यथा नरत्व प्रमिथिर नरस्य यथा नरत्व प्रमिथिर नरस्य सह अहम् विचारः सह अहम् विचारः वपुः वपुस् वपुर् वपुर् आत्मभावे कम्पाउण्ड् वपुस् आत्मा भावे सहायकारी फर मार्गनस्य स्व आत्मा स्वात्मा स्वात्मा ऐक्य सिद्धाव स पुनर निरर्थः यथा नरत्व प्रमितिः नरस्य। It says, saha aham. That means, I am that. It's like saying tattvamasi, you are that. Aham means I, saha. I am he, literally. So I am he or I am that. It's a way of saying, I am Brahman. Or I am the Atma, which is limitless. So, because saha is masculine, be I am the Atma. I am the self, the Paramatma. I am the Atma. I am the self, which is limitless. That vichara. The vichara, I am that. This analysis, this teaching, the soham vicharaha. This vichara, this analysis, and even this, this shravana. Shravana means this listening to the teaching, and manana, the reflecting on it that I am that. And also the nididhyasana, the contemplation, I am that, is a mantra. Repeating, you know, for that we use in Nididhyasana, I am that, I am that, I am that, I am that, you know. Vapus atma bhave, vapuhu vapur from vapus, this is a compound, atma bhave. It says, when one is taking the self, right, when the atma bhava, the conviction of the self being the body, vapus means body, so being the physical body or the subtle body, the stula sharira, the sutra sharira, or the combination, what we call karya karana sangata. That Swamiji uses this all the time. It means the combination of the body, the mind, the sense organs, this whole upadi that we can take to be me, everything that can take the ahankara, I am this. So whether you're talking about the physical body or the subtle body or the combination, he says, as long as, or while, one is taking the self, the oneself, to be the body, this vichara, he says, is sahayakari. It is expedient. It is useful. It goes along as a support, as a help. It's helpful. It's a helper. For what? Paramarganasya. For the seeking of the Supreme. Para means, when we say para or parama, what we mean is the stesha kala vastu aparicheda. Means, what is param? What do they mean, this word supreme? It's not a good translation. So when we say para or parama, it means that which is free from time, it is free from space, the limitations of time, the limitations of space, the limitations of any type of quality. It is infinite. It is one without a second. Right? What is parama? has no limitation. Now, when you say that, really understand what that means, to say that something is parama and has no limitation. We use space, akasha, as an example. In a sense, in many respects, space itself, in terms of the space, air, fire, water, earth, space has no real limitation in that it pervades everything. Nothing gets in its way. If I take like a cup and I move it from point A to B, space is not rattled by the cup. You're not ripping space as you move a cup through space. So space pervades everything, and it's therefore not limited by anything in that sense. It's all pervasive, and nothing comes in and contains it. We could say this is room space, but it's really not. If I knock down the walls, nothing would happen to space. Space pervades everything. Okay, so we say in that way, you know, space is limitless in terms of its pervasion, you know. But then, and another way, if space isn't even limited by itself, like, we can't say that there's a space over here and a space over here. There's only one space. It says, but this isn't even limited by its fill. There's not two spaces. There's only one space. And that way also. It's very close to being limitless. But then we can say space isn't water. Space isn't fire. Space isn't, you know, space isn't space, air, fire, water, earth. Space isn't earth. You know, so all of the elements differentiated from the other four elements. And so space, we can't say space is limitless, because there's things which it is not. For something to be limitless, look at here what they say, it can't be limited by space, desha, means it has to be in all places. There's no place where it is not. There's no spatial limitation. Also, there's no kala, there's no time limitation. Like for everything that we experience in the world, there's time limitation in the object. It comes and it goes, right? Space is even gone when you close your eyes. You can be in a state that's free of space. In deep sleep, you're free of space also. Space has the limitation like that, but what is limitless can't have limitation of time. Means it has to be free of time, right? That means that the presence, its presence as is always here. See what I mean? That's free of time. It doesn't grow old. It doesn't have a beginning. It doesn't have an end. And it doesn't modify in between. So what is parama, what is supreme, is something that can't be altered or hurt or changed by space, not by time, nor by quality. There can't be an object, that object which limits it. So here, like we can say this is a room full of quality, a room full of objects, a room full of colors, a room full of shapes. And so for something to be free of the vastu, free of any type of quality, it has to essentially be that quality. But not one quality. It has to be the truth of all qualities in order to be free of all qualities. If it's the truth of all qualities, then it's not limited by any given quality. And so here, when we say our search for what is para or parama, or margana. Margana means the search, the inquiry into. It's like, is there anything, what is my nature? You know, what is the vision of the whole Upanishad is you are that Brahman. You are the one who is deshikala vastu aparicheda. That is your being. So in your search for that, these Mahavakyas, which are the essence of the entire teaching of everything the Upanishad has to say. The essence of what the Upanishad has to say is you are Parama. You are that Parama. You are Brahman. You are that one that is limitless. You are that one without a second. Because if there is a second, that second thing limits you. You have to be everything. You have to be the truth of everything, or that thing limits you. You have to be the truth of time, or time limits you. You have to be the truth of space, or space limits you. You have to be the truth of all objects of the world, or they limit you. Now, when you say the truth of it, when you say the truth of something, then what does that mean? It can't be you're the truth of it as though you pervade it, like space, but then there's that second thing that you're pervading. So that's not the truth of space, it's not the truth of air, of water, for instance, or space isn't the truth of table. It pervades the table, but it's differentiated from the table. For something to be the truth of the table, it has to be the self of the table. It has to be the essential nature of the table, the essential nature of the lamp, the essential nature of the rug, the essential nature of me, and the essential nature of you, and the essential nature of the entire creation. Essential nature means like this, the actual, what is actually there. Like, what is the essential nature of a clay pot? What is actually there? It's clay. That's how I'm using this word, essential nature. What is it that is actually there? Okay. It's clay. So there's no dwaita, there's no duality between the clay and the pot. Right? Because there's only one thing that is really there. So there's advaita. There's non-duality between clay and pot, if we're talking about a clay pot. So essential nature means what is it that is actually there? Okay? That is Padma. So the Mahavakya, what is every Upanishad and every Prakarana Grantha like this, every explanatory text like this, what they are revolving around, every sentence that they're saying is pointing to or supporting this Mahavakya, which literally means great statement. So what that is, you are that, Padma. You are that one. You are that one without a second. Okay? So now what Ramana is saying, repeating these Mahavakyas, like Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman, my nature is infinite. Repeating the Mahavakya, the Tetramasi, you are Ishwar, you are that. Repeating this Mahavakya, studying the Mahavakya, contemplating on the Mahavakya, meditating on the Mahavakya, all of these things, all of these activities are very useful. They aid, they're helpers, they help in this inquiry into your nature, which is Padma. And they help you in this seeking when, as long as you're taking yourself to be the body or the subtle, for that amount of time, it's useful. But then he says, Swa'atma aikisiddel. He says, however, when one is established in the oneness of your own being, swa'atma. Swa'atma means one's own self. Atma, the self. Swa'atma, one's own self. The aikya of one's own self, the oneness of one's own self. By oneness, it means the only thing that is here is me. Right. So, I am the table, and I am free of the table. I am the cup, I am free of the cup. I am the rug, I am free of the rug. I am the universe, I am free of the universe. I am free of the universe because, not because there's a universe separate from me, but because there is no being other than me. Like the clay can say, I'm completely free of the pot. Why? Because from my standpoint, there's only clay. So I'm completely free of this universe and all of the maya, all of the changes that are coming and going, because really, in truth, there's only me. Subjectively, you can say, I am free of my mind, because as the mind, the maya, the mind is continually changing, it's coming and going, coming into being, going out of being, coming into being, going out of being, but being is not coming into being, going out of being. The thoughts are coming into being, going out of being. I'm not coming into being, going out of being. See what I mean? So being is the constant. So if I say being is the constant, being is not an object, being is me. My amness, I am, the amness is the constant. And all these experiences are coming and going in the being, which is me. You can't say being is coming and going, because if being was coming and going, where did it go? It's like the self was going then. The thought, if the thought had been, when, or had amnes, when that thought goes, then that person would be going, that person thought would be going, you know. But that's not the experience at all. The experience, that's why I was having in the meditation, just have you sit there. Just recognize your experience. Nothing happens to you. You are the constant. All experience comes and goes within you. You cannot get away from that experience, actually. If you can get away from that experience at all, it's only because you're quietening your mind so that there isn't a lot of coming and going of experience in you. But you can't do anything about you. You can't do anything about the amnesty or the abiding of your own being. It simply is, and it is always the same. No emotion touches it, no perception, no imagination, no memory touches it at all. And so he says, this repetition or even analysis of or meditative practice of, you know, I am Brahman or even I am Ishwar, all of these Mahavakyas, they are useful as long as you take yourself as the body. But once you have recognized your oneness, your being, which is Advaita, which is non-dual, which is really the self of everything, which is changeless, then doing that again, I am Brahman, I am Brahman, I am Brahman, is nirartha. He says, it doesn't serve any purpose. Artha means a purpose, or a meaning. Nirar negates nirartha. It's without any meaning. It doesn't mean anything. It has no purpose. And he gives an example. He says, yata, just as naratva pramitihi narasya. It's just like, just as for a human being, a nara, a man, or for a woman, you know, for them to meditate on their humanness. I don't have to walk around now saying, I'm a human being, I'm a human being, I'm a human being, I'm a human being. If I was taking myself to be a monkey or taking myself to be something else, then, you know, if I had a misconception and I spent, you know, lifetimes in that misconception, you know, then somebody gives me some understanding about who I am, then, but I keep forgetting it or something. Then I could say, you know, I'm a human being, I'm a human being, I'm a human being, I'm not a monkey, I'm not a monkey. But I'm not a jiva, I am Brahman. I'm not a jiva, I am Brahman. Right? I'm not my body, I am Brahman. After I've seen that, right? So then, as long as that is useful for me, that repetition is useful for me, that it serves a purpose, but the purpose it's serving is that what we call the Dehatma Buddhi, is still there. The Dehatma Buddhi means the conviction that I, the Atma, myself, is this body. And I've had that conviction for years, and so I go on behaving that way all of the time, with like a self-forgetfulness. And so what I can do is use this Mahavakya, I am that, I am that, I am that, contemplate it on it, study it, until my mind recognizes and becomes convinced. It gains what they call siddhi. Siddhau is in the locative siddhi. It means it accomplishes that. It accomplishes that recognition. What recognition? It gains a siddhi that it recognizes. It accomplishes, you know, it gains that oneness of myself. Just like, but once that happens, this type of a meditation is as useless as my having to contemplate on myself being, I'm the body, I'm the body, I'm the body, or I'm a human being, I'm a human being. See? But then he says there's a doubt that comes up then, and the doubt is this next verse. He says, well, as long as I'm experiencing this dvaita, you know, then it's there. As long as I have to do the vichara on the dvaita, then the dvaita, the duality is there, it's real. And then once I know the paramartha, the absolute reality, then there's a dvaita. So that can be the next thought, so that's a doubt. So he brings this up now in this verse. He goes, dvaitam vichare paramartha bodhe, dvaitam vichare paramartha bodhe,
Tvadvaita-nitye-shana-sadhu-vadaha Gaveshanat-prak-dashame-vinashte Gaveshanat-prak-dashame-vinashte Paschacalabdhe-dashamat-tvamekam Paschacalabdhe-dashamat-tvamekam Dvaitam-vichare-parama-artha-bodhe Tu advaitam iti eshaha na sadhu vadaha gaveshanat prak dashame vinashte paschat cha labdhe dashamatvam ekam. He says, when we do this vichara means this analysis, either through the shravana, We come to the teacher as who am I question, basically. What is the truth? What is the reality? Who am I? What am I doing here? You know, is there anything that survives all of this dvaita, this duality? Is there anyone who survives death? All of this, I'm a mumukshu and I'm seeking an answer to this. Is there anything about me that survives the coming and going of this creation? Is there anything about me that survives death? Is there a God? Is there such a thing? Is this, am I one inert person? Am I just a conscious bubble in this inert creation? Is there a truth? Is there something? Is there anything? Is there any liberation? Are these just ideas or are they true? So all of these type of questions, a person comes and wants to know. So when they come to the teacher, this vichara begins, right? This teaching, this whole analysis that involves the discovery of that truth to be gained. So when you come to the teacher to begin this vichara, at that time there is dvaita. So he says, dvaitam vichara, when we do this when there's this analysis going on, then at that time there is vichara. So going back to this, if I'm doing the vichara of I am that, I am that, I am that, I'm either studying it through shravana, I'm thinking about it through manana, I'm contemplating upon it. So he says now, when this vichara is going on, then, and at that time when it's useful, at that time I take myself to be the body. There's that conviction there. So now he says, okay, so when this vichara is going on, there is dvaita, there is duality. Then paramartha bodhe, but when there is knowledge of the paramartha, the absolute reality, bodha means knowledge, paramartha means absolute reality. Paramarthika satyam, this paramartha, it means literal definition of satyam, or that which is true or that which is real, is that which can't be negated in past, present, or future. That's the definition. So that means that which is free from, that which is changeless, that which is free from time. So, when there is knowledge of the paramartha, the absolute reality, whereas when there's knowledge of the absolute reality at that time, there is a dvaita. So there's dvaita when you're ignorant, you know, when you have to do the vichara, but when you gain knowledge, the paramartha bodha, when you gain knowledge of the reality, then there's a dvaita. So it says, thus iti eshaha na sadhu vadaha. This statement, this understanding is not correct. This understanding is wrong. Sadhu means it's right, it's correct, it's good. Vadaha means this statement, this conclusion is incorrect. You say, because listen to what's being said. It's like when we're doing the vichara, there is duality, but when we gain knowledge, there's advaita, there's non-duality. So that means that we are making a transition from duality to non-duality. So he says, this isn't correct. This statement is wrong. It's not correct. Na sadhu, okay? He says, he gives an example. Gaveshanat prak. He says, prak, before gaveshana, before the inquiry, Dashame vinashte, when the tenth man is lost, right? In the tenth man story, everybody knows it, right? You know the tenth man? Okay. Yeah. Okay. When the tenth man is missing, vinashta means lost or missing or absent, or destroyed also, but here it means when missing. So, dashame vinashta in two locatives. When the tenth man is missing, dashame vinashta, paschacha, and later, labde, when found. So when the tenth man is missing, is absent, is gone, missing, and paschat, and later, when the tenth man is found, dashamatvam ekam, there is still only tenth manness. Right? When the tenth man is missing, the tenth man is there. Mm. When the tenth man is found, the tenth man is there. Mm. Right? So, it's the same thing for me. When the reality for me before inquiry is dvaita, advaita is still there. And when advaita is recognized, advaita is still there. Nothing happens. The phenomena here, the thing that with self-knowledge or with knowledge of reality, you know, reality is not gained. Right? It's just like knowledge of the tenth man doesn't produce the tenth man. The tenth man has always been there. The problem is that the mind of the tenth man, and of all of the boys in this case, doesn't recognize the tenth man, and so all of their behavior is as though the tenth man is not there. Right? All behavior, all of their thinking, everything that they're doing is based upon the absence of the tenth man. But when they recognize the tenth man, they're recognizing the tenth man that has always been there. There's not a new discovery of the tenth man. The tenth man hasn't just been born. However, the way your whole orientation, everything that you've been thinking about the tenth man, now totally changes. The only thing that doesn't change is the tenth man. The tenth man doesn't change at all. But all of the thinking changes. It's the same here. Reality is reality. It is what it is. But say you take reality, what actually is, to be something else. Because of ignorance. Right? You experience reality just like the tenth man, it has the self-experience of being of the tenth man, whatever that is that boy's experience. And so when he gains knowledge, oh, I am the tenth man, he's not gaining a new experience. He's simply recognizing the experience that has always been here, but in a different way. But it's not the gain of a new experience. So here, Advaita is here. It has always been here. It is the reality. And so when you gain knowledge of it, you are not gaining a new experience. You're just getting rid of the ignorance that had caused you to take your your experience erroneously. You know, it's it's like if I, for instance, using this logic that we use all the time called anvayavyatireka, if I really without thinking or without any type of analysis, I take myself to be what I experience. I take myself to be any given experience that comes and goes. Like first, let me give an example. Say if I have an emotion. Emotions are always a good example. Say I have an emotion. I take myself to be the emotion. Even though I illumine the emotion, I'm aware of the emotion, I'm there before the rise of the emotion, during the emotion, and after the emotion passes. Now, that's an obvious thing. I'm here, the emotion is here, I'm here, the emotion is gone, I'm still here. The anvayavyatireka would be this. The anvaya would be the emotion is here, that shows that two things are interconnected. It's just a good logic to apply all the time. The emotion is here, I am here. Right. That's the anvaya positive. The emotion is here, I am here.
The emotion is gone. I am gone. No, that would be the vyatireka. That's the negative. I am here. The emotion is here. The emotion is here. I am here. The emotion is gone. I'm gone. Then we'd say there's a real relationship there. But what if you say, you can't really say that, so what you have to say is, well, when the emotion is here, definitely I'm here. Definitely. But when the emotion is gone, I'm still here. So what is my relationship to the emotion? You would say the emotion depends upon me, but I don't depend upon it. The thought depends upon me, but I don't depend upon it. That's anvaya vyatireka. When the anvaya works, but the vyatireka, the negative, doesn't work, then the seeming identity is false. It's false because I survive, I'm there before, during, and after the experience. Now, what we're doing in the meditation is that recognition that, in fact, I am there constantly, without any change, present to all experience. Once I make that distinction, then you start to notice, well, okay, who am I? What is my nature? The one that is here, always, versus the one that is going. Right? I have to differentiate what always remains. What is the constant, no matter what the experience? What is the constant? And as I recognize, as I recognize that experience, I'll say things like this. As one starts gaining this type of knowledge, it's something more like this. Oh, I am not said. I that I have always taken myself to be the I that has always been the constant. The me is actually never subject to any change at all and never has been. The recognition isn't of a new me, it's the recognition that I've always been free. The me that I am is the me that has always been free. See the difference? It's like the tenth man saying, oh, I've always been here. Doesn't say, oh, a new tenth man. No, how silly. I have always been here. I have always been me. I have always been the tenth man. The tenth man was never missing. And with self-knowledge, that's what it is. Ah, I am free. I have never not been here. I have always been this. And now, even as you look back through all of your experiences, you recognize nothing has ever happened to me. That's why we use these types of logics, like you say, the one who is the little girl. I was a little girl. I was 5 years old, and then I was 10 years old, and then I was 15 years old, and then I was 20 years old, and now I'm 60 years old. That I has what we call an anuvritti. The I is always there. The one who is now is the one who was 20 years ago. Those were my set of experiences then. It's like when you're old, I remember my mother saying, I'm more or less, and Bertrand Russell also said it, here I am in this old decrepit body, but I'm the same one. I'm the same person, who was young. Now I'm in this old body. But it's the same me. Nothing's happened to me, but I'm stuck in this old body. My mom said that. Because that is your experience. But there's been no differentiation. That you say those words, but you think, how can I grow old when I'm not growing old? That's the experience. How can I grow old when I'm not growing old? Because both are happening simultaneously. The body totally depends upon you for its being while it is there. But you don't depend upon it. The mind totally depends upon you while it is there, the vritti, the thoughts. But you don't depend upon it. At the very same time, in the very same place, there is you, who is Brahman, who is changeless, who is Parama, changeless and free, and there's the swirl of continually changing experiences. The swirl of changing experiences, moods, emotions, perceptions, doesn't touch you at all.
You know, we think and have it conditioned in various ways, like, oh, gee, I mean, really to know myself, or for me to really be fully present, I have to do this and that to my mind. I have to bring my mind into a certain state of experience. That might be helpful until you've recognized yourself. But once you recognize yourself, that is absolutely not necessary, because you are absolutely, fully, completely present, uncovered by whatever swirl of experiences is there. It doesn't make any difference at all. In fact, you're the changeless being of all those experiences. We quieten the mind and do all kinds of tricks, this soham vichara. We do all these kinds of tricks to make the mind quiet, and make the mind do this, make the mind like this. Just settle it down, quieten it down for a minute so that I can do this vichara. So I can do this analysis, because the mind can be so involved with itself. So we quieten it down. It's useful so that I can do the vichara, the viveka, the discrimination. But once that discrimination is done, then no matter what the mind is doing, no matter what you're thinking, what you're feeling, what you're perceiving, you are there and the swirl is there. The swirl of experiences are there. But nothing is happening to you at all. That's why moksha is moksha. You recognize that you have, that with moksha liberation, it's the recognition, I am free and I have always been free. This body is not free. It's subject to birth and death and disease and it will die. So you don't get moksha. The body doesn't get moksha. The body is bound. The mind doesn't get moksha either. In this sense, the mind will go on thinking, will go on having emotions and feelings, and depending upon dharma and whatnot, the mind will be responding. The mind will be the mind in this sense, that it goes on changing. It's not like you get moksha and the mind becomes free of time. It doesn't. The mind goes, it's a mind. The sense organs are sense organs. The upadhis stay the same. We would say, though, so the only thing that gets moksha is what already has moksha. Right? The self is free. And moksha is the recognition of that free self. So the one who is free is the self. Now, on another level, the mind gains a certain freedom. It gains the freedom of recognizing that its self is free. Right? That the I, which had been the mind had given over to its thoughts and machinations, is actually stable, that I am the stable being, which is the truth of the mind. And my nature is full and complete and whole and free. And so the mind is freed in that it has discovered a free self. The mind, in its discovery of a free self, a self that is whole and complete, becomes free because it no longer has to seek that free self amidst things that by their nature aren't free. I mean, imagine trying to get a free, whole, complete self by attaching yourself to something that is limited by time and space and quality and subject to change and subject to birth and death. So how are you going to be free with that? You're just going to be more bound, because now not only are you limited, but you're stuck with something else that's limited. Now you've got two limited things that are trying to hang on to each other. And so it's the most insecure. Yeah. And so the freedom of the mind is the recognition of the self that is free. The freedom of the mind is the recognition of the ananda that it is seeking is my own being, not something that has to be attained. So the mind is released of its from its ajnanam, and recognizes that I am free. But the I isn't stuck on the mind. The I is resolved into me, the one who is the self of the mind. And this me that is the self of the mind is the me that has always been me. And I just recognize that the me that has always been me is free and independent of the mind and the body and the sense organs. So the mind, the body, and the sense organs aren't independent of me. And that is your experience. You just have to, at every moment of any moment, you just notice, nothing's happening to me as all of this is happening. All of this is happening in me, but not to me. And so with the mind's recognition of that, it becomes free because it can never lose the freedom of myself. See what I mean? So here, he says, he uses this example. It's not that you have gone from Dvaita to Advaita, or from the dual to the non-dual. You are the non-dual. You've always been the non-dual, but always will be non-dual. You know? It's just a matter of, it's just simply a matter of recognition. Mm. That's when nothing happens. When you gain knowledge, and at the same time, oh, I know, Tibby, it's okay. Nothing happens when you gain knowledge, and at the same time, it'll be okay, wait, it'll be okay. At the same time, everything happens. See? Everything happens on a relative level. I don't know what should be.
Tippy.
Little tippy. Should be alright. Okay, let's stop there. Purnamidam, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamidachate, Purnasya, Purnamadaya, Purnamevavasishate, Om Shanti, 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 Harihi Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha, Harihi Om.
So in reality, there is no bondage.
No. If there was bondage in reality, then there would be bondage.
Yeah. Except that the mind thinks it's bound. Or it takes the identity to be bound. Once you know that, it seems to me the Upadhis still have a sense of being limited or being time-bound.
Because they are. You have to remember, you know what the teaching really, we use Drishtivaveka, the seer seeing differentiation and all of that to try to differentiate your own presence. But in the end, the relationship is not seer seeing. That's useful. It's a teaching tool. But it has to resolve into satyam mitya. Satyam mitya, what that means is the satyam is that which is always there, upon which the mitya depends. So for instance, clay pot, the clay is satyam, what is actually there. The mitya, the pot, is mitya. It has no being at all apart from the clay. It has no, you can't pull it away. And at the same time, the clay is not dependent on the mitya. So satyam is independent, mitya is dependent. So here, why that's important is that in reference, say, just for you as a jiva, in reference to your body, for instance, the body totally enjoys yourself. You can say the body is yourself, right? The body is me, but I am free of the body. So that I am and I am free of the body is the satyam. But the body's, the being of the body, you know, is me, means without me, this body has no being. That makes this body mitya. But now, what's important about that is that your self-experience, because this body, because there's a subtle body, and the subtle body, and it reflects as though consciousness, and it pervades this body has the sense of self. Right? Legitimately so. But the sense of self, your being, the self, doesn't require the body. Same with the mind. The mind totally requires is dependent upon you, but you are not dependent upon it. And that means that these experiences are there simultaneously. Whereas, so when we sit quietly, for instance, and you're watching all the different perceptions and thoughts, that Maya is what it is. It's an ongoing display.
Yeah.
But at the same time, right, at this very same time, you are not going through any type of...
Yeah, so if that's the case, then we shouldn't really expect to have the mind or the body feel free and limitless. Because
it isn't. The body is not.
So if you have that feeling, then that's a normal situation. I mean, that's the case.
Yeah, because the body is limited. The mind is limited. The sense organs are limited.
Yeah.
Thoughts are limited.
Yeah.
The universe is subject to change. It's going through it's limited. Everything in the universe is limited by change, by birth and death. Right? But as all of that is taking place, all of that is taking place in what is changeless.
Mm-hmm.
The being in which it's taking place is changeless. So you have the changeless amidst, in the whole Bhagavad Gita, there's so many verses like this, the changeless amidst the changing.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So you are the changeless amidst all of the changing. And it's not the changing is over here and the changeless is over here. The changeless is the truth of the changing.
So you shouldn't expect this sensation of being limited to vanish. It vanishes in terms of recognition of my presence is always present.
Or it would be more like the ahankara, the I, resolves into, is labeling you the changeless. Right? And so the experience of the limitlessness of yourself. Remember, limitlessness is not spatial. And it's not limitless in terms of time. It's timeless. It's free of space, free of time, free of change. What makes it limitless is that there is nothing else that has any being for it to compete with you. You know? So that's why we analyze the whole creation to try to find the thing here. There's no thing here. For there to be two. Well, there's me and then there's this thing. Right. So the me, this self, the limitlessness of yourself is recognized because it's changeless, it's non-objectifiable, it's free from time, it's free from space. It's the very self of all beings. We have so many teachings and illustrations, just like, for instance, the dream is an illustration to understand how a whole universe can come in me. Comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me. The same way the creation comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me. So you have to recognize this phenomena amidst in your experience. Michael?
This is bringing up a question for me. So there's this I am limitless awareness, and there's always this jiva called Michael with this body, which changes, but it's still, there's something kind of ongoing and continuous about it. And when I think about it, it's like you have a different jiva, and, you know, it seems like there's all these little jivas, and so how does it work that, you know, if the mitya is different for each jiva, how is the satya the same?
Oh. Well, the satyam, the mitya. Okay, let me just back up a little bit. When we say satyam and mitya, these two words, this is my fault, I didn't make this clear. Satyam is an order of reality and mitya is an order of reality. So we would say, if we were to say that something is satyam,
mm-hmm.
it would mean that it exists in all three periods of time, past, present, or future. That's its order of reality. It's free of change. It's timeless. Okay. So that would be the order of reality. What in the universe could we say is satyam?
Mm.
So nothing.
Mm.
Because everything in the universe is subject to change coming and going. So nothing gets that order of reality. Then we could say the second thing, word, is mithya. Mithya means that which is, we experience it, but it's not satyam. Right, because it's subject to birth and death, and it's bordered by non-existence. And at the same time, we can't say that it doesn't exist. Like, they'll use the example, like the horn of a rabbit, or the son of a barren woman, something that's actually not there. We can't say that about this creation. It is actually here, but it's not real. We would say it doesn't have reality of its own because everything in the creation is bordered by non-existence, birth and death. And so we say, it's here, we're experiencing it, but it's not satyam. So we call it mithya. Now the definition of mithya, it says an order of reality, is in Sanskrit, it kind of has a nice sound, sad asad bhyam anirvachaniya. Means anirvachaniya, it can't be categorized, can't be described as, explained as. Sat means satyam, that which exists in all three periods of time, which actually is, or that which has no existence. And so, when we look at this creation, everything in this creation enjoys being, but has no being of its own. It is. Everything that you experience, even in your mind, every thought you have, but it is, as long as it's there. But it doesn't have isness because it goes away and isness, being, remains. Right? And so the whole reality that we experience is really divided into satyam, that which is, and nothing fits that definition except for the self. Because consciousness, being itself, can't be objectified. It's not subject to time and space. It can't be objectified. But it is. And so it's, I am the one that the self is free of time. Nothing else. Everything else is mithya. It comes into being and goes out of being. You know, and so the whole experience then is going, the whole experience that we have is differentiated into these two orders of reality. What actually is means it's not bordered by non-existence. Now, the problem with it being bordered by non-existence is nothing can come from non-existence. Because why? Because there's nothing there for it to come from. So we're using literally non-existence, meaning nothing is there. So nothing can come from something that is not there. Right, and so...
It does.
Yeah. If something's not there, there's nothing for it to come from. And so that means that in the end, all of this universe, all experience that we have, it enjoys being when it is there. Right? But it depends when it's there. It's depending on being, which it itself doesn't have. Right? Because it comes into being and goes out of being. But being doesn't come into being and go out of being ever. That's why, in fact, that's what gives all experience stability, because I, the being which I am, is always there. That's why I can go so smoothly from waking state to dream state to deep sleep state, back to waking, dream, deep sleep, no problem, because nothing is happening to me. You know? But the me actually extends the entire universe. I am, my being is being, which is consciousness, which is the very personal me. But if I rip off this body, no problem. Rip off the mind, no problem. You know, rip off the universe, no problem, because I still am. The I, what I take to be the I, which I've now identified with the body, mind, sense organs, I recognize, oh, this very personal me is Brahman, is being itself. I am the being. And you experience yourself as the being, as being. It's just you identify it, superimpose it onto two things which don't have any being of their own. It's not being, it's just being. And everything enjoys it. Like even if you were to go like this, I am, and then I say you are, so now we have am and are, And it is, that painting is. So am, are, is. We talk like that. That's language. But there is no objectification of being or isness. You know? You're labeling objects as you are and you are and you are and it is. But really, as long as you'll do it, you know, jokingly, you might as well just say, you know, I is, it is, you is. Or I am, you am, and it am.
So the identity is with the isness, existence.
You're always.
It doesn't change.
It never changes. When you say, I am, you know, I, you're talking about yourself as a conscious being. That's the bottom line. You're not going to say I'm inert. You're not going to say I'm unconscious. I am a conscious being. But the thing is that, and that's true. If you stop there, mm-hmm. if you just stop, what if you say I am the conscious being? Mm-hmm. Or what if you just say I am conscious being? But once we say I am a conscious being, and you say I am a conscious being, there's a whole bunch of us. But the conscious being part is right. And in fact, when you're labeling I, you're labeling you the conscious being. But then you add all the baggage onto it that we call the upadis. I am the conscious being, which is this body, this mind, sense organs born at this particular date. You know, so we tag on all of the mitya onto the conscious being. So the conscious being becomes the mitya, and the mitya becomes the conscious being. Conscious being becomes the body, and the body becomes the conscious being. Mm. So I take on the limitations of the body, and the body becomes, you know, me. And that's all this has to be sorted out, because even experientially, that's not how it is. Even in your experience, once we go into this vichara on the actuality of your experience, like we were slow, let's admit it, Vyasana, when we slow down, this teaching in meditation, like when we do a guided meditation, just slowing things down and making you recognize something about your experience.
Yeah. I know you've answered this question clearly before when you asked about dementia. But I just have a friend now who's descending into what seems to be like true madness, just in a month, a few weeks. Going from a functioning person to somebody who isn't functioning at all.
Yeah.
And I know, I mean, I'm assuming you'll answer, well, it doesn't matter because of what you just taught. But I guess it's the way I'm experiencing it's hard to...
Let me explain one way that may be helpful. This table doesn't have a subtle body. And as a table, it doesn't have a brain either. Sorry, it's not going to get dementia. Table won't get dementia. You know.
It won't fail.
But this, you know.
Rats.
What? Yeah, because it doesn't have a sukshma sharira. It doesn't have a subtle body. So, you know, but this body, mind, sense organs can get dementia. It can get all kinds of things. Right? That will affect its experience and its relationship to me. Like, for instance, if the brain is not working, then that brain is not, because of dementia, it's no longer functioning very well. Right? So then in reference to me, the me, this brain is going to be having its own series of experiences. But me, that is the self, of the brain and the body and the table, the I, my sense of self, will never change at all. It's kind of like now I have a functioning mind, right? And me, the conscious being, is illumining, to use these words. I am present to the self of this functioning mind. Now the mind is not functioning and it's giving me all kinds of different experiences.
Like voices or...
Whatever it is. Now I, the same me, exactly the same me, is illumining these weird experiences. or schizophrenic experiences. Right? So from the standpoint of the upadhi, that's not a very happy thing. But from the standpoint of me, I am exactly the same. It's just like, say, if we look at our own experience prior to dementia, hopefully maybe none of us will ever get that. Okay. But look at just your series of experiences now. Sometimes you have a happy mind. That's fine. That's a nice mind. Sometimes we have a very peaceful mind. Nice mind. You know? Sometimes we have an angry mind. Or, you know, afraid mind. These are frightening experiences. Confused mind. You know, hurt mind. Depressed mind. Painful experiences. They are what they are. Whatever they are, those are the experiences that that mind is undergoing. Sick body. Those are the experiences that that body is undergoing. But the body is not free, never going to be free of birth and death. You know? And the brain is not going to not grow old. It's just the eyes are going to dim, the ears dim. You know? All of these things happen, but those are all what goes on to the upadhi. But even for a person who is mind is not working and they're totally have total dementia, their sense of self is exactly the same.
So that sense of me will be just
exactly
as vibrant as it is now.
Just as vibrant.
With the functioning.
That's right. But now you have to think like this is going to get confusing for you because the mind is not necessarily vibrant.
Yeah, I was just going to ask.
It's not that the mind stays
lying in your bed and you can't get up, you can't talk.
Oh, yeah. The upadhi is not functioning. Yeah. Now, remember this too. Like, you can kind of notice this when you're in contemplation. Your self is not thinking. Your self is not having emotions. It is not having any type of running commentary. It simply is, you simply are what you are. And you are whole and full and complete in and of yourself. But yourself is not having a commentary like, oh look, I'm getting dementia and I'm so sad, mm-hmm. you know, that my brain is rotting away. That's your mind talking as it's getting dementia. You simply are, you know. That's the truth of it. Mm-hmm. Now say your body gets old and decrepit and your mind is gone. Then this upadhi is becoming more and more like a table. You know, it's not becoming non-functional.
The psychic part is...
Yeah, to whatever degree, or to whatever degree the brain is not functioning, to that degree the subtle body doesn't have a brain to use. Mm-hmm.
Right. What does the term subtle body mean exactly?
Subtle body means from the... from how the Upanishads describe the... what they call the jiva, the transmigrating person. We would say that there's this physical body that is born and dies on this plane. But there is a subtle body that takes the physical body. You know, like in, say, in Christianity or Judaism, more Christianity, not all Jews believe this, that there's a heaven and a hell. A lot of Jews accept that now, but I'm talking about other, just religions. That means there's a soul that goes to heaven or hell. In the East, what they don't just look at it like that. They look at it transmigrating, that you don't just go to heaven, you're born here and then you drop the body and then you go to heaven or hell. They look at that you have a subtle body, what we would call like a soul, that transmigrates, takes body after body after body. And that soul, that we don't call soul really because it has more Christian connotations, we call it a jiva. The jiva is the subtle body that transmigrates. So if I want to look at, okay, what are the components of the jiva that actually transmigrate? We would say there is the mind, which is made up of the memory, the citta, the buddhi, the kind of decisive thinking, the manas, which is both emotion and just fluctuating thought, and the ahankara. So that's the mind that transmigrates, along with the subtle, the sense organs, which take on physical organs. The mind will take on the brain as its physical counterpart. The sense organs will take on these physical sense organs. Then there's the organs of action, like when the subtle body feels this body, then you have the ability to grasp, the ability to talk, the ability to walk. Those capacities fill this body. The ability to procreate, the ability to evacuate waste. And then you have the pranas, what we call the five pranas that enliven the body, like the circulatory system and the digestive system and the in and outgoing breath and the peristaltic movement. So these are capacities, 19 capacities, that make up the subtle body that transmigrates. Now the subtle body is also not the self. Right? The self is the same in all beings, but the subtle body, the difference between you, a living creature, you, say a plant, animal, these all have subtle bodies, and this, is that you with the subtle body as though reflect consciousness, like the mind enjoys consciousness. The physical, the sense of touch pervades the whole body, so the body enjoys consciousness. Sense organs enjoy consciousness because of the subtle body. It's like the difference between if I hold a mirror and a rock up to the sun. They're both inert. They're both Maya in that sense. But this mirror has qualities that the rock doesn't. Right? And so the rock is illumined by the sun, warmed by the sun, but it doesn't reflect the sun. The mirror also is illumined by the sun, warmed by the sun, but also reflects the sun. That's the difference, like between the subtle body and the physical one. So here, now what's interesting, this table, from its own standpoint, is not a conscious being. Where this body, mind, sense organ seems to be a conscious being. But actually, the me doesn't belong to the body, mind, sense organs, or to the table. The me, that what makes you you, belongs to you. Conscious, the conscious being. The me-ness, your identity of what makes you you, you know, when you say me or I, what that I, sense of I lands on, is free of the upadi, it's free of the table, and it's free of the body, and it's free of the mind, it's free of the rug, it's free of the space.
And free of the subtle body.
Free of the subtle body.
And the subtle body is considered a jiva, right?
The jiva.
Well, okay, yeah. So while we're getting upadesha right now, is the subtle body listening in on this, or what happens?
That's the subtle body. Using this physical body is gaining knowledge.
Pardon me?
The subtle body, which is with this physical body, is gaining knowledge.
The buddhi is.
Yeah, the buddhi. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right, exactly.
And the capacity to gain the knowledge is that one person would be able to do that and another not.
Yeah, because you have to, first of all, you have to be an adhikari. That means you have to be a qualified student. Qualified student means you recognize the problem, because who's going to sit and listen to all this? You know, I mean, you have to figure, you have to
Why
be interested, right? Like grandma, I'll never forget when my mother said, oh, honey, I don't have that kind of problem. You know, to have to listen to all of this kind of stuff. I don't have those problems. But we have the problem. That's just an adhikari, qualified student. You know, the viveka, vairagya, shamadam, all of these mumukshutvam, these. But it's considered in the, kind of in the tradition, that actually, they always praise the student, you know, which is part of the teaching tradition, actually, to acknowledge and praise the student, because it is not ordinary for a person to have enough inner space to question, to say, who am I, or what is the truth, or is there a God, or what is... That is not... ordinary, to where you take that question seriously and you really want to know. I mean, these can be passing thoughts and whatnot, but you don't really care that much.
Why do they need to praise this, that student, that particular student?
Well, because it's considered great punya, you know. It's just it's considered a great thing, you know. In the tradition, there is really nothing higher or more valued than self-knowledge. That is the highest. That is the pinnacle of being a human being. But, and now, so, say in a culture like in India, which now India is also very westernized, but say in ideal India, the India, the mythological India of the Ramayana and the, but not to put present day India down, even every householder, everyone in the culture holds that, you know, that gaining knowledge, self-knowledge, as their highest value. But they all know that, oh, I'm not quite ready for that yet. You know, I can do that later. You know, do that when I'm old and it's time to take sannyasa after I've raised my family and
do my duty.
Done all my dharma and everything. Even pundits who, and they all revere, but they're not adhikaris. It's not quite where they're at right now, but they know that it's there and that's their highest value. And that's why the sannyasis, you know, all of the sannyasis are so honored in India, you know, because, and not so much now, because the culture has become westernized and, but in its prime, the sannyasa was the most valued, because the person who took sannyasa means they were dedicating their whole life just to that pursuit of knowledge, of self-knowledge, right, which is the pinnacle of the whole culture. And so say somebody embarks on that pursuit seriously, they take brahmacharya or they're living a life of karma yoga and that is what's primary to them, that person is highly, highly respected in the culture and praised.
Does that phrase also serve as a function of so that student won't...
Yeah, to give you a little encouragement.
Get discouraged.
Yeah. And
say later with this, I got something else.
You know, yeah, but if you really do have something else, you know, then this is just one of those things that will be interesting to you for a while.
Yeah.
However, if you do have some mumukshutvam, and the teacher will, because it's part of the teaching, will finish you off in terms of the mumukshutvam, because they make the problem so clear.
Yeah.
But that mumukshutvam has to be, you know, that desire for liberation has to be there to some degree in order to even have the interest, you know. If you have the mumukshutvam to enough degree to bring you to this teaching, even to meet a teacher, you know, to come into the tradition is considered great punya. It's like a needle in a haystack. You know, they use that example, or a glass, you know, a diamond amidst glass beads. What brings you to this teaching? You have to have. The inquiry in your own mind has to be appropriate to the teaching, mm-hmm. or what will attract you to it. Mm-hmm. So that's all. They give a lot of praise. Okay.
Oh, wonderful.